Coming up 1 month after Nepal's devastating earthquake, Kim Lawton looks at the ongoing challenges for relief and recovery. And as the nation marks Memorial Day, many female veterans, some of them single mothers, say they come back from war to neither jobs nor homes. Bob Faw visits one organization trying to help. Plus, Judy Valente reports on St. Benedict's Preparatory School in Newark, New Jersey, successfully educating young men from the city's most troubled neighborhoods.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Welcome, I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. 1 month after the devastating earthquake in Nepal, humanitarian workers are still struggling to help the more than 8 million people affected. Kim Lawton has more about the challenges of delivering immediate aid while also working for long-term recovery.
Humanitarian groups have been rushing to get desperately needed supplies into Nepal, but it hasn't been easy.
There's one runway in Kathmandu, and even just a few weeks before the earthquake, that had been shut down because a Lufthansa flight had gone off the runway. Can you imagine all of these relief supplies trying to get in to Kathmandu? The roads from India are there, but they're clogged. So getting the supplies in has been a major logistical headache.
Kent Hill leads international programs for World Vision U.S., one of the largest Christian humanitarian organizations. Hill was in Nepal less than 2 months ago for discussions about how relief groups could be better prepared in this earthquake-prone region.
I came back exceptionally concerned. I just didn't think it would hit this fast.
World Vision already had 200 staff in Nepal, and the group has sent in 50 emergency experts.
The first task, obviously, is to save lives. You've got to do that. You've got to get food. You've got to get shelter. It's already cold in Nepal. It was cool in the evening and near freezing now at night, and these people are in tents. So you've got to get them shelter. You've got to get them blankets. You've got to get them water.
Hill says Nepalese children are especially vulnerable right now.
Over half the population was already considered poor, living on $2 a day. It means that already there were big child exploitation problems, trafficking in persons, child labor, early marriage. The children are already in trouble. And in any kind of a disaster like this, the pressure for the problems to grow worse on children grows tremendously.
World Vision is establishing what the group calls child-friendly spaces.
To give some regularity and routine to their lives again, a place they can color and play where counselors are in case they've lost parents or loved ones.
The next few weeks will be key as the region prepares for monsoon season. Emergency officials warn that thousands more people could die because of infrastructure problems caused by the earthquakes.
Anytime the water supply is disrupted, you've got the possibility of cholera, you've got other waterborne diseases, that can hurt. We've got probably several million people who don't have access to food now like they did before. And remember, Nepal already was prone not just to earthquakes, but to floods and to drought. So you've got a food problem, you've got a water problem, you've got a health problem.
Even as they're distributing immediate aid, Hill says his people are also working on more permanent solutions.
You have to be thinking now, what do you do to mobilize those resources, to get the economy going again?
And as rebuilding efforts move forward, Hill says it's imperative to make structures that are able to withstand future earthquakes.
You've got to start with the hospitals. You've got to get those buildings retrofitted. You need to do the same thing with government buildings and the schools.
He says workers on the ground must decide how best to allocate limited resources.
They have to make immediate decisions about where do you put your effort. The resources flow in, but what are you going to do? And what do you do if you don't have the resources you need right now? So these folks are some of our most creative and innovative people working in humanitarian organizations, are the ones who say, I don't have everything I want. What do I do in these circumstances?
And those are tough decisions.
They're very tough. I mean, you're surrounded by people with their hands out, and they're desperate. And to turn somebody down who may not be in a life-threatening situation to get somebody who is can create tension. You have to handle that diplomatically. It takes a lot of work, and it takes a lot of expertise, and a lot of people aren't really cut out for this kind of pressure.
The Nepal disaster comes as resources at World Vision and many other humanitarian groups are already stretched thin, dealing with other crises around the world, such as the flood of refugees and internally displaced persons, IDPs, in the Middle East and Africa.
We may have maybe 3 million people displaced by what happened in Nepal. But do you know in the last 3 or 4 years, we have well over 12 million, half the population of Syria have been displaced. There are over 50 million refugees and IDPs in the world today. That is the most since World War II.
Hill admits the enormity of the needs can be overwhelming.
The only way you get through that kind of what I call the temptation to despair is to not think of a million or 12 million or 50 million people in need. It's to think about that one person, that one child. And once you've had any contact with one person whose life has been transformed or saved or preserved from a disease, once you've seen one life change, you say, it is worth it.
I'm Kim Lawton reporting.
This Memorial Day weekend, we remember military men and women who sacrificed their lives in service to the country. There's also concern about those who've returned from war and are trying to resume their lives. We have a report today on the problems of women, many of them single mothers, who've been in the military and come back to neither jobs nor homes. Even the Veterans Administration concedes that the services available for female veterans are not as extensive as those for men. But correspondent Bob Faugh found a place where some homeless female vets are getting the help they need. It's called Final Salute.
For women who serve in the American military, especially those with children deployed in Iraq and Afghanistan, the toughest challenge can be when they come home. Veteran Chiquita Pena.
We're very proud people in uniform. You know, we want to keep ourselves together. We want to be the problem solvers, the fixers, you know, the leaders. Well, when you go from being a leader to being a person that needs the help, that needs the hand up,
That's rough.
It's rough, and it hurts.
The Department of Veterans Affairs says that from 2006 to 2010, the number of homeless female veterans doubled. Veronica Witherspoon is one of an estimated more than 15,000 women vets who ended up homeless.
We go to war, protect our country, and we come home to nothing.
After deployment in Afghanistan, Navy Reservist Witherspoon ended up living with her mother and felt, she says, like damaged goods.
How did I become homeless? Like where do I begin to look? How do I pick up these pieces? Because at that point, I felt broken. Like somebody just pushed me down and I just fell apart.
Deployed abroad twice, Army Reservist Chiquita Pena, whose husband was also abroad, was jobless and needed a place to live with her 2.5-year-old daughter, Nayeli. Final Salute got her back on her feet.
We stereotype homelessness with, you know, for lack of a better term, you know, a hobo or a bum or someone who's a wino or drinking on the street. This is the new face of homelessness.
What do you mean by that?
My face. I'm what homelessness looks like. What Final Salute does is keep you looking like this before you end up on the street.
Jaspin Booth, a former Army captain, not only understood the problem, she decided to do something about it.
We have a core set of principles called warrior ethos. A portion of that warrior ethos is to never leave a fallen comrade. And that was my main reason for putting my own money up front, because these are my sisters. I took an oath, and I'm bound to that, and I had to honor my commitment.
4 years ago, with $15,000 from her own pocket, she opened a house for homeless female veterans and named her organization final salute.
Once you're dead, you don't know if you're getting a final salute. For some people, they need that final salute now. They need that act of respect in their time of need.
Final Salute, funded now by private contributions, is in Alexandria, Virginia, and houses up to 8 single women and women with children. Housing and food are provided free for up to 2 years, although a lot of women stay for less time. Veteran Cynthia Stevenson.
She helps you with everything you need. Financially, she gives, they have classes, you know, to help you learn how to take care of your finances. Classes on how to, you know, get your mind together and get prepared for the world, you know, especially if you're coming back from any deployment.
At Final Salute, no one is coddled. There's a zero tolerance policy for drugs and violence and biweekly sessions with a social worker.
We could write, you know, a list of our top 5 things that we want to accomplish in 2015.
The emphasis, says Booth, is on personal responsibility.
They clean the house themselves. We don't prepare their meals. They cook, they feed themselves and their children. You know, so again, we will give you what you need to succeed, but we're not here to give you a handout or hold your hand. We'll offer them truly a hand up, but they know that it begins with them.
13-year veteran Booth knows a little something about starting over. In 2005, not only did Hurricane Katrina destroy everything she owned, she's also a cancer survivor. But all that, she says, wasn't the hardest part. Though Veterans Affairs supplies homes for male vets, very little was being done for women.
The hardest part of that experience was being told that because I was a woman veteran, there was nothing available to me. That's what really got me beside myself, because I was basically told because I wasn't a man, I was not as important, and my service wasn't as important.
What kept her going, she says, was her anger, her determination, and faith.
I believe that God puts you through certain things in order to prepare you for a greater mission later on in life. He doesn't give anyone a failing mission or a failing calling. However, he doesn't give you a roadmap either. So especially dealing with nonprofits, you know, sometimes you don't know where the money is going to come from or if it's going to come, but he hasn't failed me. And so that's why I always say divine intervention.
The Department of Veterans Affairs, which has vowed to end homelessness this year for veterans, says there's an acute need to improve services for female vets. The General Accounting Office found that 60% of shelters for female vets do not accept children. Both the VA and the GAO found that in those shelters, basic protections like locks and separate floors for men and women were often lacking.
To put you in a transitional housing facility where there are like hundreds of men and a few women trickled here and there, how is that even safe or logical? And some of these facilities are co-housing women with registered male sex offenders. Like, how is that? I mean, who does that?
At Final Salute, one of just 5 shelters like it in the country, Booth says she's been able to help over 350 female vets, like Haley Zimmerman, who after deployment in Afghanistan says she would have ended up on somebody's couch.
I can save money. I can finish my school. It allowed me to be able to accomplish the things that I need to move forward.
Final Salute helped Veronica Witherspoon, who now has a job.
It's kind of like being in a sorority. You have that connection because you all have been through that basic training. You've been deployed.
Could you have done it without Final Salute?
Without the support of Final Salute and my family, if they weren't there, I don't think I would be the person I am today.
Help to Chiquita Pena, now successfully housed with her daughter and husband.
They kind of show you the light at the end of the tunnel. Like, hey, you know what? It's not that bad. Look, there are other service members just like you. You're not a dirtbag. You're not, you know, a failure. You know, you're not a failure.
Jazz Booth hopes that someday Final Salute will go out of business. For now, she concedes, that's little more than a pipe dream.
We were created to fill an American void. If I'm still doing this 20 or 30 years down the road, we are still not getting it as a country. And we're just making up for effort as a society to take care of all of our veterans. We have enough wealth, power, and influence. You know, we can liberate other countries and, you know, clear up their natural disasters. You know, women veterans are now Americans' natural disaster.
As more and more military women return from service, Jazz Booth will continue to give them both a final salute and an opportunity. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, This is Bob Faugh in Alexandria, Virginia.
In the midst of the violence, drugs, broken families, and poverty that plague their city, Benedictine monks in Newark, New Jersey have found ways to successfully educate young men from the most troubled neighborhoods and enable nearly all of them to graduate. Their secret? Judy Valente reports.
Newark, New Jersey, a city struggling to overcome a host of problems.
We're talking about a 32% poverty rate, third highest in homicides in the nation, high unemployment, low academic performance from the high schools. So we're looking at a city that is in great need and is suffering.
Mary Lou Buongiorno is a filmmaker who was working on a series of documentaries about her hometown when she discovered this place in Newark's inner city, St. Benedict's Preparatory School, led by a group of 13 Benedictine monks. With a student body that is 80% African-American and Latino, the school has a near-perfect graduation rate. 95% of last year's senior class went on to college. The secret to its success? St. Benedict's operates more like a monastery than a school. The main subject taught here is community.
You see signs all around the place, whatever hurts my brother, it hurts me, right? So that to try to get kids to understand that, to live that. That's the great sense of living in a monastery.
But St. Benedict's is the school that almost wasn't. It was established in 1848 to educate the sons of upwardly mobile Italian, Polish, Slovak, and Irish Catholics. But the riots of 1967 drove many white students from the school. After the Newark riots and with enrollment dwindling, St. Benedict's Prep closed for a year. A third of the monks left to live in another monastery, but a core remained behind, determined to revive this school.
I mean, we're here as a sign of God's presence, of faith. That's kind of who we are as monks. We take a vow of stability, of place. And so even though the neighborhoods change around us on a regular basis, we stay.
It's 9:15 a.m., time for the entire school community to gather for the daily convocation, what the students refer to as convo. Color-coordinated sweatshirts identify the different classes. Student leaders report the day's attendance, discuss upcoming activities. Everyone has a chance to say what's on his mind. In the centuries-old tradition of monasteries, they sing a hymn, then pray lauds or morning prayer.
A reading from the Holy Gospel according to Luke.
St. Benedict's has 13 buildings, an Olympic-sized pool, two gyms, and a large theater for student-led productions. But few who attend can afford to pay the annual $12,500 tuition. The school must raise about $6 million each year through alumni donations and grants from corporations, foundations, and area financial institutions. Violence occurs daily in the neighborhoods where many of these students live. But here at St. Benedict's, there are no security monitors or even locks on the lockers. The emphasis is on personal responsibility.
So many times in schools, they run so heavily from the top down. I don't believe that's helpful to kids, especially to young men of color, because so much in their life is they feel like they have no control over.
Much of the school's philosophy is based on the 1,600-year-old Guide to Monastic Living, the Rule of St. Benedict.
In terms of silence and in terms of relationship with God, community, forgiveness, you know, there's a lot in there that resonates with them. And I think it's always amazing when they finally, they're looking at the rule and they say, oh, that's why we do that here.
For instance, students who commit serious infractions in most cases are not suspended or expelled. Taking a page directly out of St. Benedict's rule, they are, quote, excommunicated for a time from the school community.
You're trying to get them to reflect on their inappropriate behavior within the context of community, so you take them out of the community.
When Jahir Jones, an otherwise stellar student, got into an uncharacteristic fight with another student, Father Edwin required him to assist at Mass on Saturday nights and participate in a Bible study. Like most of the 536 students here, Jones is not Catholic. He's a Pentecostal Protestant. His mother welcomes the emphasis on Catholic monastic practices.
The relationship that the monks have with the students, and I do like the way that they talk to them. I like the way that they treat them. I like the way that they give them a sense of community and a sense of really hope.
Mooka Poole was impressed by a cousin who attended St. Benedict's and then went on to college.
Going to college isn't something I'm used to, and my family isn't used to. So when I heard this, I was surprised. So he told me, Mooka, you got to go there. You got to go to St. Benedict's Prep. This is the school you got to go to.
Mooka has been accepted by St. John's University in Minnesota. He is one of 60 students who live on campus in a building next to the monastery.
Well, my neighborhood is unsafe and dangerous. If I wasn't living here, I'll tell you the truth, I'd probably be here at 11:30 at night anyway.
There is also a strong emphasis on counseling, which takes place daily as if it were a core subject.
None of us like to look at ourselves when things are difficult.
Groups like Unknown Sons, whose members never knew or have little contact with their dads.
I'm here because I don't know anything about my biological father.
I'm here because I don't talk to my dad at all.
I'm here because I'm hurting so bad on the inside, but I can't show you because I'm a man. And if I'm a man of color, the only way I can express emotion is violently.
What we've discovered is a lot of what manifests itself outwardly as poor academic performance has very little, if anything, to do with cognition. I mean, it has to do with emotional distress that a young man's going through, so that they begin to turn anger in on themselves and little by little destroy themselves.
But St. Benedict's can't always protect its students from outside influences. Tyrone Higgins was a student leader who went on to the University of Delaware. But just 6 weeks before his college graduation,
I participated in an armed robbery with three other students, which led to my incarceration for 3 years.
He served his time, and a court has since expunged his criminal record. He now works for a corporation where he's been placed on a management track. Teachers College at New York's Columbia University is considering writing a study guide that uses St. Benedict's as a model for urban education. Father Edwin says he's asked all the time if St. Benedict's methods can be replicated elsewhere.
I think two things are essential. Whoever the head of the school is needs to live there, needs to be open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And in order to do that, you've got to, it seems to me, you have to have some kind of a community present.
As with most American monasteries, few monks have joined Newark Abbey in recent years. There is some concern about what will happen to the school if the monastic community doesn't grow. And raising $6 million a year is always a battle. Father Edwin says he doesn't spend too much time worrying.
All I can hear is the voice of the Lord to Moses, go forward, don't stop, and a way will open.
Father Edwin says in the end, it's all about teaching these young men that their lives have meaning.
Who am I? What am I here for? Now, when you're talking to a teenager about that, they look at you, they roll their eyes. So you teach so that they have something to refer to when these questions begin to well up in their heart about the meaning of life, the meaning of their life in the face of death, and what does it all mean?
And as long as there is even a single monk left, Father Edwin says that is the mission St. Benedict's Prep will continue to carry out in the heart of this city. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Judy Valente in Newark, New Jersey.
Finally, on our calendar, Sunday is Pentecost for Western Christians. According to the New Testament, on Pentecost, the Holy Spirit came to Jesus' followers in the form of tongues of fire. And for Jews, the holiday of Shavuot is this weekend. Shavuot marks the giving of the Torah to Moses on Mount Sinai. Some Jews gather in synagogues and homes to study the Torah all night long. It's also a harvest festival, which many celebrate by eating dairy foods like cheesecake. That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook and watch us anytime on the PBS app for iPhones and iPads. There's also much more on our website where you can listen to or watch every program. Join us at pbs.org.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Be more. PBS.